I'm David Wallace Wells, the deputy editor of New York Magazine and the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, which is a book about climate change and everything it's going to transform about the way we live on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
I've written a few things over the last couple, last month or so. Mm-hmm. I think probably the one you're referring to is about things maybe not being as bad as mm-hmm. they seemed. That came about because, in short, I just started seeing among climate scientists and energy analysts whom I trust and admire a lot more skepticism about the particular climate scenario, which was introduced in the UN reports and has formed the basis of a lot of climate science over the last decade or two, that we could actually this is the sort of worst case scenario. And I was seeing a lot more skepticism that we could conceivably even get to that level of warming this century, in part because changing trajectories for coal use in particular are looking considerably better than they looked a decade or so ago. And so it's very hard to imagine a scenario where we produce enough emissions that by the end of the century we'd get to about 4 or 4.5 degrees of warming, as the UN told us to expect, given our existing understanding of what's called climate sensitivity. Now, this is sort of wonky, but it's possible that even if we produce less emissions than we thought was possible, nevertheless, we'll produce as much warming because it will turn out that the climate itself is more sensitive to the perturbations of emissions than we had previously understood. And that does seem to be somewhat the dynamic of a next generation of climate models, which are being developed now and will form the basis of the next major UN report. Almost all of those models suggest the planet's climate is more sensitive to emissions than we had previously thought. So even though there's sort of considerable good news about our emissions trajectory in the long term, there may be counteracting bad news coming from just how sensitive the climate is. On net, I think we're still in a better place than I thought we were personally a year or two ago. But it's also almost impossible now to imagine that the planet pulls up short of 2 degrees of warming, which is a level of warming climate scientists call catastrophic. So whereas for a while it's been a rallying call, we need to stay below 1.5 degrees, activists say that all the time, I think practically speaking, we've run out of time to do that. And so we're looking at a narrower window of climate futures. You know, a few years ago, I would have said something between, and it will end up anywhere between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees of warming. I think now it's likely we'll end up between 2 and say 3.5 degrees this century. So the window is narrower, but it's not just good news, it's also bad news, because as much as the extreme warm scenarios are becoming less likely, so are the really optimistic positive outcomes. And given how bad things look as soon as 1.5 degrees and certainly at 2 degrees and above, it's really not all that comforting to know that something like 4.5 degrees is off the table if it means that we're going to end up north of 2 degrees.
So the odds of ending up anywhere below 2 degrees are shrinking, or are they gone?
I would say they're gone. Scientists say that if we immediately stopped emitting carbon tomorrow, probably we'd get about 0.5 degrees Celsius of warming from just the carbon that's in the atmosphere already, which would bring us to about 1.5 or 1.6 degrees. Now, I think that given all the political and economic and cultural obstacles to getting to zero carbon immediately, I think that something like 2 degrees is about our best case scenario. And I don't think it's really likely that we avoid it.
That's with 200 million climate refugees, right? That's the level of that. Storm damage at 100 times what it currently is. That's what we're almost unavoidably looking
at. Deaths from air pollution, 153 million people would die from air pollution. Some of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East would be so hot during summer that at least during heat waves, you couldn't go outside without risking heat stroke or death. And we'd at just north of 2 degrees, scientists expect we'd be locking in the permanent loss of all the planet's ice sheets, which would take centuries to unfold, but we would have made it inevitable at that level of warming. And over those centuries, that would produce 250 feet of sea level rise, which is enough to drown at least 2/3 of the world's major cities. So, you know, this is a best case scenario. It doesn't sound like a best case scenario. It sounds completely horrific. And I think that's one of the mind-bending features of the experience we're going to have over the next century. Things we used to consider unthinkably bad will be our baseline, our best case. And we'll have to start to wrap our minds around what it would mean for the world to get even warmer than that.
I'm glad you've started to deal with how this situation affects us, even outside of the climate.
Yeah, that to me is really important, and it's been one of the really under-discussed aspects of this story. I mean, I come to climate science not as a scientist and not even as a science journalist. I'm a, you know, I'm a general interest magazine writer, and my interests are as much, you know, literary, sociological, political, economic, cultural, and I see the impacts in all of those places. It's one of the things I tried to do in my book is get beyond the question of just what the direct impacts are from climate change, but how it will contort and transform and deform, say, our politics and geopolitics, or our economic activity, our emotional lives, the way we tell stories.
How can this happen?
Well, each of those is a different question, but to take the geopolitics, for instance, if you were to imagine a world that was defined by dramatically more warming than we have today, you would imagine a growing intuition of resource scarcity, a growing sense of zero-sum competition for what abundance there still exists on a planet that is nevertheless burning. And as a result, more nations of the world embracing narrowly nationalistic understanding of their own role in the world and retreating from international alliances, which they would see as compromising the needs of their citizens, and more sort of autocratic populistic leaders who were really focused on securing the well-being and advantage of their citizens as against the rest of the world. Now, describing that those politics, I think it's fair to say that we're already somewhat down that path. When you look at, you know, leaders like Donald Trump here in the U.S. or Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Scott Morrison to a certain extent in Australia, Vladimir Putin in Russia, you are seeing a growing movement in this direction, and that's quite concerning. I'm not ready to say that each of these leaders is themselves a the result of climate change, but I would not be surprised to see more people like them emerge in the decades ahead as the public begins to understand just how dramatically transformed the planet could be by these forces. And the truth is, you know, Donald Trump, one of the things that he rode to election on was concern about immigration. That immigration from the U.S. southern border is the result of climate changes. Now, there are other factors at play, but Central America has been really hit punishingly hard by climate change, and that's one of the main reasons why there was a growing influx of migrants from Honduras and Guatemala and the rest of Central America over the last 10 or 15 years. So it's, you know, the relationship between climate and politics is, I think, a lot more striking and dramatic than we often allow. There's a relationship between temperature and conflict. Scientists expect that for every half degree of warming, you get a growth of about 10 to 20% in conflict. And that means that if the world is, you know, say 3 degrees warmer, you could see more than half as, you know, half again as many wars as we have today or more. And I think, you know, we already see some of that when you look at the conflict in Syria, for instance. That was a civil war. It's not exclusively over climate issues. Lebanon next door dealt with the same drought and survived. The political system remained intact. But that's exactly how climate is going to play all around the world. It's not going to be the case that any example of political instability is exclusively and entirely the result of climate change. But climate destabilizes all these systems and as a result makes political disarray much more locally on a global level. So we're likely to see more of that too. On a cultural level, you know, I have a almost 2-year-old daughter. I've been reading a lot of books to her when I put her to bed. And it's really striking to me how many of these books take place in the natural world with animal protagonists. We have in the West, even as we've sort of largely removed ourselves from real engagement with nature, we've retained a sense that the natural world is a place for teaching and a place for learning. It's a sort of parable venue that can show us how to live with one another and a way for us to instruct our children and ourselves about how to be good in the world. We still talk about animals and their interaction with one another in that way. And yet, all of these stories, I find, are set in environments that are at least threatened, if not gone forever. And that is a really strange thing to be sort of, you know, moral instruction is a little, it's not exactly how I'd understand what I'm doing when I'm reading books to my daughter to put her to sleep. But it's one of the things that these books do. And yet they're drawing on environments and experiences that are disappearing from the planet rapidly. When you take seriously the number, the staggering numbers of animal decline and insect decline, you know that the natural world that even our grandparents grew up with is going to be very, very different by the time that we're grandparents ourselves, maybe even gone forever. There are measures of insect declines, measuring 60 or 70% globally. The World Wildlife Fund says that 50% of mammal life has died since 1970, 50% of mammal life since 1970. And in all of those ways, I think we're changing our the stories we tell as well. You know, it used to be the case when we tried to dramatize global warming in Hollywood or in science fiction, those stories were extremely didactic. They were trying to impart a political lesson. I think we're getting to a tipping point there where we're starting to understand that climate change is just a sort of background feature of all of our lives and will be a part of, you know, romantic comedies that we produce and will be a part of political dramas that we produce. You're starting to see that in some television shows already. I think you're going to start to see more of it in the decades ahead, even in the years ahead.
This is part of climate normalization.
Absolutely, which is something that I think is both healthy because we are going to be living with a transformed world and we need to adjust to that and adapt to it, and also really concerning because it allows us to define more and more suffering around the world as normal, and as a result gives us an excuse to not act as fast as we should if we were behaving in a truly moral, responsible way.
Speaking of that way, do you see anybody really grappling with the end game of climate, of this climate disaster? I mean, really, and not everybody, are there people deciding now that not everybody is going to be able to be saved out of this?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's the decision that we're reaching as a species without much forethought or consideration. And that's the most tragic part. We're imposing incredible burdens, incredible amounts of suffering on future generations, but we're doing that mostly blindly. We're sort of sleepwalking into those scenarios rather than planning for them in a direct way. Now, when you look at something like the wildfires that have devastated Australia over the past few months, you're starting to see down there some real discussion of how habitable that continent will be over the course of the century or the next centuries. And I don't know exactly how that will shake out. I don't think that the millions of people living in Sydney are simply going to up and move to New Zealand, for instance. And I think that this is, it's helpful for us to think about our climate future given in that way, because people like you and me sitting and observing from a distance often think, okay, it's either going to be okay or it's going to be disaster. But the truth is we're inevitably going to end up somewhere in the middle, dealing with some amount of quotidian difficulty, some amount of real tragedy and pain, and some amount of humanitarian crisis and catastrophe. And where we end up on that spectrum in different parts of the world is ultimately up to us, but also how much of that we agree to accept and live with is up to us. Now, again, imagining 30, 40 years from now, I don't think Sydney is going to be totally abandoned, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if it were a less flourishing, less dynamic, less populated city than it is today. I think we might see, especially across the wealthy West, where many self-interested people are really focused on quality of life and air quality and that kind of thing, a sort of competition to see cities advertising themselves as relatively healthy and happy places to live, even in the midst of a global climate crisis. And I think that that will change some population dynamics going forward. I think it's certainly an open question how the cities of South Asia and the Middle East respond. I don't think it's practical that we're going to like air condition those cities entirely, which means there's going to have to be some decision made about, not just at the policy level, but at the individual level. Are we comfortable living in cities where every year tens of thousands of people die because of extreme heat? Or is that going to be enough of a prompt that those populations really shift and move? And if they do, where are they going to go? Are they going to move internally to other cities in the same nation? Are they going to move more, make farther trips into societies that are more alien to them? And what kind of political disturbances will those produce? I think all of these questions are really quite profound. Ultimately, when I take try to take stock of the big picture, what I see is a century that is defined in almost every particular way by the changes brought about by global warming. And I don't know exactly what shape those changes will take or exactly what shape our response will take, but I feel quite strongly that this will be a century defined by these forces in the way that, say, the 19th century was defined by modernity, or the late 20th century was defined by financial capitalism. Climate change will be everywhere, inescapable, and the question is how we respond to it, not whether we can beat it, because unfortunately that battle's already been lost.
The big variable human response at this point.
And on many different metrics. So you have how quickly we decarbonize, but you also have how quickly we take action to protect the vulnerable populations.
Any indications on how,
Well, I think, you know, on both of those fronts, you know, practically speaking, we're failing quite profoundly. There was a, I don't remember the exact number, but in the Paris Accords, the wealthy nations of the world promised to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on investment in the developing nations of the world to give them the tools they needed to adapt and protect their own population. And some tiny fraction of that money has actually made it to those countries. Basically, none of those commitments have been honored at all. But we're doing just as bad on the decarbonization front, where the Paris Accords were signed just 3 years ago, and already no major industrial nation in the world is on track to honor those commitments. The only two countries in the world that are considered even compatible with the Paris Accords are Morocco and Gambia. And, you know, in many parts of the world, globally, emissions are still going up. In many parts of the world, coal use is still going up. We're really behaving abominably. Even though we know we need to be acting, there's a kind of a collective action problem where each individual nation doesn't want to go first and take more dramatic action until they see the rest of the world following. And that's really maybe the biggest problem, I think. You can imagine the politics of individual nations moving on some of these issues, I think, especially if our leaders start talking not just in terms of the cost of action, but the cost of inaction and the opportunities of investment in decarbonization and resilience. But thinking more globally, you know, each individual nation, with a possible exception, depending on how you look at it, of the US and China and India, each individual nation is responsible for such a tiny fraction of the global emissions pie that they think of their own contribution legitimately as trivial. And the big challenge is global, which is another reason why it's so concerning that we're at the moment retreating from so many of our international alliances and the spirit of globalization that presided over the last few decades, because we really need that coordinated global action to have any hope of getting a handle on this challenge. But at the moment, the returns are, I think, really quite grim. Now, there are signs of progress here and there if you want to look for them. The cost of renewables has fallen dramatically almost all around the world. You know, in many parts of the world, they're now cost competitive with dirty energy. In some parts of the world, it's cheaper to build new renewable energy capacity than to continue running dirty fossil fuel infrastructure, which is incredible. And yet we've responded to those gains not by retiring that fossil fuel infrastructure, but simply by growing our capacity to produce power, which means proportionally, we actually haven't globally, we haven't grown the ratio of clean energy to dirty energy in 40 years. We've just made the whole system bigger and bigger. It's also the case in Europe. There have been some dramatic gains over the last few years. The UK has done really remarkable work, especially cutting out coal. Similar progress has been made in parts of Scandinavia, and those countries are making pledges to do even more in the next decade or two. That's really quite dramatic and encouraging, and it lines up with a moment of unprecedented political mobilization around climate, which I think is really quite encouraging. On the other hand, even given that political transformation, I worry we're seeing more sort of empty rhetorical gestures than we are real committed action when we need it most. So you see, you know, Justin Trudeau and the Canadian Parliament declaring a climate emergency and then the very next day approving a new oil pipeline. Or in Europe, you know, Emmanuel Macron attacking Jair Bolsonaro for his terrible behavior in the Amazon, which is terrible and deserves to be called out. But Macron himself failed to pass a carbon tax in France last year, famously against the Gilets Jaunes opposition. You know, he actually took a further step this past week and said that France would not sign any trade agreement with any nation that was not honoring the Paris Accords. This is a quite dramatic step. I think, actually, I've been imagining that I've been expecting it to happen at some point. I do think we're going to start to see climate issues become more and more central to all geopolitical negotiation and rivalry. But this was a sort of unprecedented commitment. And in a certain sense, is a sign of progress. On the other hand, France is not honoring the Paris Accords. So you start to wonder, what are these, you know, what are these, what do these gestures really mean?
See any move toward cutting our fossil fuel subsidy here in the U.S.?
Well, at the moment, not really. I do think that in the U.S., the market forces have done so much work that already fossil clean energy is cost competitive, and that's quite good. Globally, we need to end fossil fuel subsidies. We definitely need to do that in the U.S. as well. But the pressure is a little less intense here because the progress of renewables has been so fast. And the truth is that the lion's share of what most economists describe as fossil fuel subsidies is not direct subsidy. It's just the fact that carbon is not priced in a way that reflects the environmental cost that's imposed by using it. And imposing a carbon tax or a carbon price that does reflect that, what's called the social cost of carbon, is a politically really challenging problem. I mean, the Gilets Jaunes movement in France is one example of the kind of backlash that we could see. But in the U.S., even in 2018, in a kind of blue wave election year, both the state of Washington and the state of Colorado, Washington especially, a very green, very blue state, failed to pass a carbon tax. And you see very, very reflexive public opposition to that kind of pricing mechanism, even when we're talking about carbon fees that are so small, they would practically speaking make no difference to our consumption patterns. You know, Exxon has now come out recently in support of a $40 a ton carbon tax, which is, you know, obviously $40 higher than the U.S. has at the moment. The IPCC, the UN body, says that by 2030, we might need a carbon tax as high as $5,000 a ton to avoid catastrophic warming. So more than 100 times the size of the Exxon proposed tax. And nowhere in the world is there a tax operative that is even 1/100th of that $5,000 a ton price. So I think that we're likely to see, even sooner than we see a sort of quote-unquote fair price on carbon imposed, I think we're likely to see more direct government interventions into carbon emissions. You know, things like insisting that car manufacturers don't produce non-electric vehicles for personal use after, say, 2035 or 2040. You're starting to see cities across Europe banning non-electric cars on their streets on that timeline. And those kinds of interventions, or, for instance, more subsidies for renewables to roll out and deploy that capacity more quickly. I think you're likely to see interventions of that kind and regulations about land use and agriculture and buildings and that sort of stuff more than an all-encompassing carbon price, because I think that the public opposition has proved so difficult there. Now, there's some people who say we could solve that by making those returning those carbon fees to the public in the form of a dividend, which is actually perversely the way that Alaska works with their oil money, so that you would basically get back from the government a check in exchange for the carbon price. Personally, I'd rather see that money, if we do raise it, spent on R&D and that sort of thing. But at the moment, I think it's likelier we see more targeted interventions rather than a sort of single price on carbon established.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thanks for that overview. What do you see next in this field? Anything you just sort of see glimmering out there?
Well, one thing that I've been thinking about that is concerning to me is the prospect of solar geoengineering, which is a method by which we would sort of artificially cool the planet by suspending particulate matter high in the atmosphere. It would probably be sulfur. It would probably turn the skies red. But it would be considerably cheaper to depress the global temperature that way than through conventional decarbonization or through other forms of what are called negative emissions, which would allow us to take carbon out of the atmosphere. And as a result, many people I speak to, climate scientists, but also policymakers, also investors and that sort of those sort of power brokers, see this as some degree of inevitable because it's so cheap. and it will allow us, it'll buy us some amount of time to decarbonize in a smoother, more gradual, more comfortable pace. But it's been almost entirely unstudied by academics, which means we have very little sense of what the impacts would be. And there are some early signs that the impacts would be quite damaging. Early studies show that the effect on agriculture would, you know, the effect of having this particulate matter in the atmosphere would totally counteract the beneficial impacts of a lower temperature. And of course, it would do nothing for oceans because the oceans would continue to take up carbon from the atmosphere as well. So we would see continued what's called acidification of the oceans, which contributes to coral bleaching and the dying off, the mass dying off of fish populations, which are so important to so many populations around the world who depend on them, not just for commercial purposes, but for diet. This is really just at the very outset of research projects into this area, but we're starting to see, I think, a tipping point here too, where the federal government is now spending research money on solar geoengineering, and Harvard and MIT have established a research initiative too. It used to be the case that it was considered, anathema for academics to do research in this area. They couldn't even get funding for it because looking into it was considered sort of a way of being supportive of continuing the fossil fuel industry, and as because it was an excuse for them to continue acting in the way that they had. I think that's bad because I think we need to know what we're going to do if there's even a slim chance that we're going to do it. I think it's good that we research it. And I'm really interested to see where that research goes and what it tells us, because I think that there is a strong impulse and really, frankly, the force of social momentum will take us to solar engineering unless we have real reasons to avoid it. So it's important that we get that science right and understand just what the consequences of that kind of program would be.
It would be kind of like sliding a particular layer between us and the sun.
Yeah, basically the way that this whole system, climate change, works is that, you know, all the heat that we have here is because of solar radiation we get from the sun. A lot of it is reflected back into the atmosphere. Some of it is absorbed by the Earth. And carbon that hangs in the atmosphere is a sort of a blanket that makes the planet cooler, makes the planet warmer. It means that more of the solar radiation is absorbed by the planet than is released back into the solar system. And solar radiation would reflect some amount of sunlight back into outer space before it even got to Earth. And that would mean that we would be dealing with less heat than we would have otherwise. Now, it's important to keep in mind that we're already sort of doing this ourselves by accident, because there is a lot of particulate pollution that we're producing. And scientists expect that we're already suppressing global temperatures by perhaps as much as a full degree of Celsius, and at least by a half degree of Celsius because of that pollution. So if we eliminated that pollution, we would immediately bring ourselves up to about 2 degrees of warming, which is this sort of threshold of catastrophe, which is quite scary. On the other hand, it would have the benefit of saving millions of lives a year, because that's the same pollution that is killing so many people around the world today. So we're in a strange position where we can sort of choose to clean up the air and make ourselves healthier, but in so doing, produce significantly more warming, which will make everything else worse, or we can live with the unconscionable level of dying because of air pollution, and yet keeping global temperatures, at least for the moment, relatively temperate. In all of these areas, you know, we're at a situation now where we're basically out of good options, and we're choosing between a variety of bad options and trying to choose the least bad one. The best thing to have done would have been to take an action on this decades ago and make sure that our decarbonization slope was really gradual and comfortable. But we're well past that now, and the kinds of changes that we need to make the future relatively livable and relatively prosperous for all of us are so dramatic that almost all of them have unfortunate downsides as well. You know, for instance, the oil and gas business, which we want to put out of business, employs tens of millions of people around the world. You know, there's been a huge public outcry and response and political backlash from the decline of the coal industry. The coal industry is a fraction of the size of the oil and gas business. It's totally trivial when you talk about it in terms of oil, you know, in, compared to oil and gas. And we haven't begun to talk about what to do with all of those workers, and not just all those workers, but, you know, the oil and gas business is stitched into the American culture. They fund universities. They fund, you know, it's a huge part of who we are as a nation. And really, it's a huge part of how the world operates, which is exactly the problem. And yet, extracting that infrastructure and that economic activity is going to be really, it'll scramble things quite dramatically if we don't plan properly. And we need to do that. We need to retire the oil and gas business. We can't continue burning fossil fuels. And yet we also have to figure out a way to do that without disrupting the livelihood of these tens of millions of people all that dramatically.
One last question, David. You know, your daughter must have a different view of the world than you did when you were her age. Could you compare? What's her, you know, how does she see the world she's going to be growing up in?
Well, I think she has a very limited view. Since she's only two, so I think she's only starting to, you know, wake up to even the fact of the natural world, although it's been astonishing to me how quickly she's able to piece together, for instance, like an understanding that a forest environment contains different animal species with different attributes who interact in complicated ways with one another. That kind of thing has really been astonishing for me to see in her eyes. But, you know, when I look back on my own childhood, I'm 37 years old. I grew up in New York City, you know, came of age, born in 1982, came of age in the 1990s, after the end of the Cold War. Those were my teenage years. That's really when I sort of came of age. And, you know, I was sort of sophisticated and liberal enough to understand that a lot of the basic promises of that era were a little bit misleading. I didn't think that, you know, global capitalism was a perfect force for good. I didn't think that globalization was without its downsides. I didn't think that progress was inevitable. And I didn't think that more justice and more liberalization globally was inevitable. And yet, I did come of age in that time, sort of shaped by some of those expectations, and I certainly would have told you as a teenager that, okay, we have to fight for progress, and there are setbacks and downsides, and yet, if I imagine the life of my children, I'm inevitably, as a teenager, imagining them as more prosperous, more just, more livable and happy and liberated than my own life. And looking back, I saw my own experience as reflecting those changes when compared to my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation, too. In general, I saw history as tracing an arc of progress. And I think climate change is a really profound challenge to a lot of those expectations. I don't know just how fully we will have to renovate or even retire some of those expectations. There are certainly those who believe that climate change will require us to retire them totally, so that we won't have any expectation of progress at all, and we'll have to reacquaint ourselves and make ourselves comfortable with a sort of what's called like a steady state situation where things are neither worse nor better than they were in previous generations. I'm not there yet, but I think that it's certainly possible that climate change has that kind of an impact. Personally, I think that, you know, we're an adaptable, resilient species. We will find a way to live and probably even to define our lives as meaningful and happy, even under conditions that we would today consider barbaric. And yet, the fact that we will be able to adapt to conditions that today we would see as barbaric is not a thing to celebrate. It's a thing to mourn, because that means that we will still be, in addition to adapting, we will also be turning a blind eye to so much more human suffering, so much suffering we could have avoided if we had taken a different course. And I think all of those dynamics are going to be profoundly different for my daughter when she really starts to wake up to the world and the way that the future is changing. Even if we take a quite aggressive path, and even if we take quite dramatic action, I think that we're going to be living amidst, frankly, an unprecedented amount of human suffering in the world.
Can you describe our most likely world 10 years from now?
Well, 10 years from now, things probably won't be all that much different. But we're going to see more wildfire seasons like the ones that we saw in Sydney, we're seeing in Sydney now. And just to zero in on that for a second, you know, as Americans, we have a sense of wildfire that comes to us from California. And California has been dealing with some unbelievably bad wildfire over the last few years. I recently interviewed the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti. He was born, he's 48 years old. The year he was born, 60,000 acres were burned in California. The year he was elected mayor in 2013, it was 600,000, a tenfold increase. The year he was reelected mayor in 2017, it was 1.2 million. And last year, toward 2018, it was 1.9 million. So a 50-fold increase in just 1 year. Scientists expect that those fire seasons are going to at least get twice as bad by the middle of the century, maybe four times as bad. And they don't even know how to model the fire after 2050 because they say at that point so much of the state will have burned. They don't know what kind of plant life was going to grow back in the aftermath. And so they don't know how flammable it will be. That's how dramatic California That's how dramatic the wildfire situation in California is. And yet, the situation in Australia is much, much worse. This year, 20 times as much acreage has burned in Australia as burned in 2018 in that unprecedented California wildfire season. And maybe even more concerning, when you talk about these really even terrifying California seasons, you're talking about a fire season, which is defined primarily by anxiety. Most of the time, fires are not burning. And when they burn for a week or 10 days. The really horrifying fire in Paradise, California, the Camp Fire, that burned in just 4 hours. It destroyed an entire town in just 4 hours. The length of the fire was 4 hours. The length of the fire season may have been 4 months, but the fire itself just lasted 4 hours. In Australia, they've been dealing with fires burning now for 3 months, and they're just now beginning to be contained at all. The air pollution has been so dramatic that Sydney has registered on an air quality meter that is supposed to level out, that's supposed to top off at 999. They've registered air quality readings as high as 2,500, which is almost 100 times as high as it's considered safe to breathe. The smoke has been so bad, fire alarms are going off in office buildings, thinking that the building's on fire, and they've had to suspend ferry service in the city because the boats couldn't navigate the smoke. More than 1 billion animals have died, and you've seen the incredible images of evacuees, really better understood as refugees, having to wait on the beaches to be rescued by military forces, which is, you know, just not a scenario or scene that we used to see outside of failed states and wartime. And now we're seeing, not just by force of climate change, but in a wealthy part of the world, relatively well-equipped to deal with these kinds of issues. When those impacts arrive in places like Indonesia or Bangladesh, those countries are much more poorly prepared. And so you're seeing even now, as the world is starting to focus on the Australia wildfires, we're not even looking at the flooding in Indonesia, which has killed dozens and displaced more than 100,000 people. We're going to see more and more of those impacts every year. The heat waves, record-setting heat waves, every summer in different parts of the world, we're going to see more flooding like we saw in the U.S. Midwest, where this year the crops were so damaged that 40% of Americans' farmers' income, the entire country of farmers, 40% of their income came from insurance money and federal bailout money from the trade war with China. So already that entire industry, which we think of culturally as the very backbone of American culture, has been so devastated by some of these changes that 40% of their income is coming from other sources. And it's almost everywhere you look. These are impacts that are arriving, you know, on the coast with extreme weather. It's arriving in what's called the wildland-urban interface with wildfire, river flooding, and down to, you know, cognitive performance and development of children. You know, one of the most dramatic aspects of the air pollution research that I've been looking at recently is that, you know, the even a little amount of air pollution, nothing like people see in or deal with in places like Delhi or Beijing, even the little amount of air pollution that we see in places like Central California or outside of Houston, really dramatically changes rates of respiratory illness, premature birth, low birth weight. It affects the development of children in utero and after birth. It affects cognitive performance. It affects mental health. Almost every aspect of mental and physical health that you can imagine has a kind of climate footprint. And we're not yet really thinking about or adjusting to life defined by those forces. I think we're going to start to, which is another thing to look for in the decade ahead, to start to think about climate change as much as a public health issue as it is a concern about wildlife or sea level rise. And frankly, I think that's helpful because I think people will respond to matters of public health as much more immediate and personal and pressing than something like sea level rise, which they can choose to see as distant if they live anywhere but the coast.
Yeah, that could be helpful.
I think the public consciousness is very much moving in the right direction. The politics, the political change we've seen over the last year is really dramatic. The poll numbers are moving at unprecedented rates. The problem is, you know, to take the UN's prescription seriously, we really don't have time to wait for even that political movement to roll out into our policy at a natural pace. We need to accelerate it dramatically. You know, the UN says in order to avoid catastrophic warming, we need to roughly half our emissions over the next 10 years. They say that doing that would require a World War II scale mobilization globally. And, you know, that on some level, that's comforting because, okay, we think we've done that before. But I think we lose sight of just what a dramatic transformation of American society that was, where every man of fighting age was drafted into the military, and nearly every woman of working age was drafted into the workforce, many for the first time. Whole factories were just totally redirected towards producing other products. Whole industries were literally nationalized, which is almost unthinkable today, and redirected in the space of just months. The UN says we need that kind of transformation at a global scale. They think we actually needed to have started that last year to have a chance of having our emissions by 2030, which shows you just how total and complete a transformation of every aspect of modern life is necessary to avoid the kinds of impacts that you and I and everyone alive on the planet today would consider unconscionable if they really looked them squarely in the face and thought about what kind of future they wanted to live in. The kind of future that we're heading for would be unacceptable to anyone living on the planet today, and yet far too few of us, I would say almost none of us, are really acting with the urgency that would be required to avoid those outcomes and secure something more prosperous, something more livable, and more just for all of us.
I guess we'll have to leave it there.
Yeah, it's bleak. But I also like to remind people that the bleakness is, in a perverse way, a sign of our power over the climate. You know, if we bring these things to pass, it will be because of choices we make today. And there are a lot of reasons why it's very hard to make different choices. There are political obstacles, there are cultural obstacles, there are economic obstacles. And we have a status quo bias, and change is complicated. On the other hand, inaction is not an excuse. We're going to be making decisions over the next decade that will shape the next millennia of the planet. And it's up to us to make a set of decisions that is, at least relatively speaking, more responsible rather than less responsible. And if you think there's nothing we can do, keep in mind that what we are doing today is bringing about a complete, thoroughgoing transformation of all life on Earth. So if we're capable of that by behaving poorly, surely we can be capable of something more high-minded, hopeful, and humanitarian, at least relatively speaking. And I think those technologies and those choices are available to us if we take them. They just require real political commitment, which is why I think the most important thing for any of us to do is to try to change our public policy as quickly as we can, in part because the U.S. needs to do it for its own sake, but in part because, frankly, the world needs American leadership on this issue, because America has been a leader in devastating and destroying the planet. We need to take the lead in fixing the planet as well. So for all of those reasons, I think it's incumbent on all of us to really embrace our political roles, and sort of cast off the lessons that we were taught over the last generation, when we were taught to make our mark on the world politically through what we buy and what we consume, and remember what politics really is for, which is organizing our social priorities. Politics can reorder and reorient societies at the drop of a hat, as we saw in World War II, if we chose to do that. And the political path is available to us if we take it. We have to take it. If we don't, we'll be cursing ourselves a decade from now, and certainly 50 years from now, and 80 years from now, and beyond. So it's up to us. Yeah.